questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRadio English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, one of the ways in order to correct a society is Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahy an Munkar in Islamic teachings. Enjoining good and forbidding evil. So when they say Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahy an Munkar, the first thing that comes to our mind is correcting others rather than the self. Now the question is this, which one has priority? Self-building and self-correction or other correction?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Somehow the question may, try to come to this conclusion that as long as you are not practicing self-building, you are not allowed to enjoin the good and forbid the evil. And many of us, we are not practicing that, so no one has right to enjoin the good and forbid the evil as long as they are not, righteous people, practicing people, and so on and so forth. But the point is that, no, this is not the case, because, of course, first of all, I would like to share some verses of the Quran and the narrations talking about the significance of these two obligations, enjoining good, the good and forbidding the evil. In chapter Luqman, verse 17, one of the advisors of Luqman to his son after prayer, أقم الصلاة, to establish the prayer, is وَأْمُرْ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَنْهَا عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ, to enjoin the good and forbid the evil. Chapter Tawbah, verse 71, الْمُؤْمِنُونَ الْمُؤْمِنَاتِ بَعْدْهُمْ أَوْلِيَاءُ بَعْدٍ يَأْمُرُونَ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَيَنْهَوْنَ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. One of the features of the believing men and women is that they enjoin the good and forbid the evil. And maybe most important than all is in chapter Ali Imran, verse 110, كُنْتُمْ خَيْرَ أُمَّةٍ, addressing the Muslims, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that you are the best nation. Why? كُنْتُمْ خَيْرَ أُمَّةٍ أُخْرِجَ لِلنَّاسِ تَأْمُرُونَ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَتَنْهَوْنَ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. One of the reasons that Muslims are the best nation is that they enjoin the good and forbid the evil. And according to some narrations, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not like a believer who is da'if, who is weak. And according to the Prophet, الَّذِي لَا دِينَ لَهُ, who doesn't have any religion, meaning that he is not practicing Islam as he should or she should.
That's right.
Then the Holy Prophet was asked, what do you mean by a mu'min, by a believer who does not have a deen? This is, a weird expression to put it in this way. He is mu'min, but he doesn't have any religion. And the Holy Prophet said, I mean, الَّذِي لَا يَنْهَى عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. Yes, you are a believer, you are a Muslim in name, but you are not forbidding from the evil. This is in Al-Kafi, volume 5, page 59.
That's right.
And according to some narrations, when people stop enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, there are some calamities may befall them.
Yes.
And if they do that, then they're a blessing by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala covering them. So my point is that this is how significant is the obligation of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. And that is why as Muslims, we should not search for excuses to neglect these duties. These two duties, which unfortunately are neglected to some
That's
extent
right.
by Muslims.
So, sorry, this case, Amr bin Ma'ruf wa Nahy an Munkar, must start from within ourselves first?
There are two cases, and they are not related to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So before that, let me talk about the conditions of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. When we refer to especially the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, we find that there are some conditions for acting upon these two obligations. And in none of them you find self-building. So let me share these conditions, and then I will come back to answer your question in a more explicit way. The first condition is that as a person who tries to enjoin the good and forbid the evil, you should know what good is and what evil is.
That's
Unfortunately,
right.
some people try to enjoying the good and forbid the evil while they have no idea what good is all about.
Yes.
We are talking about al-ma'ruf and al-munkar. Mm-hmm. So as long as you do not have enough knowledge about good and evil, you have no right. I mean, you are prohibited from enjoying good.
Yes.
And although we may say that you need to go and learn. This is another story.
Yes.
But as long as you do not know mm-hmm. about what is good, what is evil, you have no right to enjoin other people toward good, because in that case you may enjoin other people toward evil.
Yes.
And forbid them from good. And unfortunately, this is the case in some events that we
some
see
cases,
around us.
The people who are not educated enough, who are not knowledgeable enough, go to do Amr bin Maruf and Nahya and Munkar, and the case is completely wise.
Exactly. Okay. So this is a very important condition. Yes. It has, of course, nothing to do with self-building.
Mm-hmm.
Now here we are talking about knowledge as one of the conditions. Yes. If you do not meet this condition, you have no right to enjoy good and forbid the evil. Quickly, let me refer to the three other main conditions for enjoying good and forbidding the evil, because they are also important. Second of all, there might be a possibility that if you enjoin the good and forbid the evil, that person would change. At least there must be a possibility. Which means that if you are sure, 100% sure, that whether you say or not, there is no change in that person, there is no obligation upon you. Again, another important point. Third, which is also important, if a person is committing a sin and he or she themselves, they are regretful and they are not going to commit that sin anymore. In that case, you don't need to go them and forbid them from evil, because already they are regretful and they are not going to commit that anymore. And fourth, there shouldn't be any considerable harm when you enjoin the good and forbid the evil.
Of course,
for each and every one of them, there are many details,
mm-hmm. yes.
and the people should refer to the books of fiqh or jurisprudence.
That's right.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Now, having said that, what about self-building?
Yes.
So, it is true that...
And whether it is a prerequisite to do Amr bin Maruf or not?
It's not.
Okay.
I mean, when we refer to jurisprudence, when we refer to the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wassalam, you cannot find any narrations to tell you that, okay, if you are not a 100% virtuous person, if you are not, practicing upon all your obligations, then you have no right to enjoin good and forbid the evil. No. We have many obligations, and enjoining good and forbidding the evil are among them.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, for example, prayer, fasting, khums, zakat, hajj, and then we have enjoining good and forbidding the evil.
Okay.
So can we claim that if you do not say prayer, then you have no right to fast? No. We are talking about two separate obligations. If you do not say your prayers, you would be punished for that. But if you fast, you will be rewarded for that. So the same is true about enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. We are talking about two independent obligations upon all Muslims. Whether they are practicing or not, this is another story. This is another scenario. Yes, if they are not practicing themselves, they will be punished for neglecting the obligations. But it doesn't mean that this is an excuse for them to mm-hmm. leave these two obligations.
Sorry, Sheikh Karimi. For example, a person who does not do Salat, he will be punished for not doing Salat. But how is it possible for him to invite the other people to Salat? Is it possible?
It's a very important point that you mentioned, and thank you for that. So now we are talking about whether if I enjoin the good and forbid the evil, it will bring any effect or not.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, if enjoining good and forbidding the evil come from a person who is practicing, it would be much more effective compared to a person who is not practicing himself or herself. But doesn't mean that me does not, not acting upon that obligation is an excuse for me not to act upon another obligation. No. So that is the point that I'm trying to say. Of course, you may not find any person who himself does not pray and may ask other people to say prayer. And the same is true about self-building, because if we tell the people, okay, that first of all, try to, correct yourself, as you mentioned in your question, and do self-building. So it means that each and every day I think that, okay, I'm not that virtuous. I need to work hard to be more purified. And so at the end of the day, no one will act upon enjoining good and forbidding the evil. Mm-hmm. So these are two different obligations. As people, we need to act upon our obligations. We need to self-purify ourselves, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, we have these two obligations as independent obligations. I mean, al-amr bil ma'ruf and al-nahy an al-munkar.
That's right.
And of course, we know that we should also refer to the fact that there are different stages for enjoining good, yes, and forbidding the evil. The first stage is deep in your heart, which means that if you see someone committing a sin, you should be, deep in your heart, you should be sad for that. Second of all, through your language, by asking him or her not to commit the sin or enjoying the good. And when we go to the practical ways, in most of the cases, especially if it is in need of power, it is not, yes, for the people, it is for the Islamic, okay, government to do that. So, as I mentioned, for the details, yes, I ask all the dear listeners, all the details are mentioned by the great scholars in the books of jurisprudence, also known as Tawdih al-Masail. But the point is that if we are not able to practically stop the people, it doesn't mean that we should ignore the previous stages.
Yes.
No, at least through, our words, and sometimes, for example, cutting our ties with some people and so on and so forth,
okay,
it may be effective for some people.
That's all right. So, as you said, the main goal of this Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahy an Munkar is a kind of massive correction, isn't it? Collective collection. We must see the effects in the society. It cannot be limited to, for example, single by single or the members of a small number of community, isn't it?
That's true. And this question, of course, reminds me of a very famous narration of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, that كونوا دعاة الناس or دعاة للناس بغير ألسنتكم. Invite the people toward goodness without using your tongues. It's a very profound narration by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in Al-Kafi, volume 2, page 78, which means that, yes, if you're able to act in a way that our actions in and of itself, they invite the people, so this is the best. This is the best society that we can imagine. We are leading a life that in and of itself is inviting the people toward the same lifestyle. So, كُنُوا دُعَاتًا لِلنَّاسِ بِغَيْرِ أَلْسَنَتِكُمْ means that if you're able to invite the people through your actions, so this is the best. But it doesn't mean that if you are not able to do so, we should neglect inviting the people by our, words.
That's right. Well, thank you, Masheikh Karim. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs on Arab English Radio, Call of Islam page. For more information, visit our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein. وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة
من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي تهران
روباشافت غازا
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Brits are still reeling from the impact of 2022. It's hard to recall a political year that's seen the country lurch from one crisis to the next, all bookended, it seems, by the saga of which particular Conservative Prime Minister was in charge. Boris Johnson had managed to cling on to power despite mounting evidence presented that his position had become untenable. His missteps during lockdown, dubbed Partygate, a faltering economy exacerbated by the outbreak of conflict in Ukraine, made his departure an inevitability. The race to replace him was brutal, exposing the deep divisions within the Conservatives. Party members chose Liz Truss over Sunak before, but that was only the beginning of the saga. Analyst Chris Bambury was following events closely and reflects on that period of chaos.
We had this strange interim where Liz Truss beat Sunak, clearly showing that a majority of the Conservative Party membership were not going to vote for Sunak for reasons which I think are fairly obvious, which I never really talked about. But Truss was a disaster. And then we ended up with Sunak being shoehorned into the prime ministership with no actual election.
I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Ah, the blink and you'll miss it Truss era. 7 weeks of chaos which saw the pound take a hit and the markets recoil at the sheer ineptitude on political display. There was a sense that the UK's political landscape had now become a running joke.
The chaos of the Liz Truss premiership, you know, was just awesome. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that in British politics. British politics is supposed to be about stability. It prides itself in selling itself, Britain, as a brand to the rest of the world, that has been politically stable. This was like Italian politics, you know, and the prime minister just coming and going. This did not give a vision of Britain as a stable political entity.
Not content with topsy-turvy politics, the UK's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, passed away aged 96, leaving the UK contemplating its colonial legacy. With King Charles III with Camilla, Queen Consort, by his side, it was a new era, but one filled with old uncertainties.
I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony, and prosperity of the peoples of these islands.
Despite the passing of the baton, the impact of Brexit, the stalemate in the north of Ireland, with the cost of living crisis biting, Prime Minister's in-tray was bulging. 2022 is also the year Britain saw a re-emergence of strike action across a multitude of sectors.
We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
We are seeing the recovery of industrial unrest, workers taking trade union action, and finding that when they go on strike, they are popular, that people sympathise with them, sections of the working class and indeed the middle class. And I think that spells trouble ahead. These strikes, we haven't seen anything like this in Britain really since the days of Margaret Thatcher. This is new, and I think people are learning new habits, new skills of taking industrial disputes, and I think potentially this is a bit of a game changer down the road.
Rishi Sunak and the rest of his Conservative government will be desperately hoping that there is not a repeat of the past tumultuous year, a 12-month period that's seen record number of Brits slide into poverty. But analysts are warning that desperate changes need to happen because so far it seems the Tories are heavy on excuses and light on solutions. On the cusp of a new year, there are many challenges awaiting the average British family. Whoever is in charge in Downing Street, it's the most vulnerable who continue to pay the heaviest price. Without firm solutions from the political class, it seems the upcoming period might hold still more pain for those who can ill afford it. Amina Taylor, London.
The Iranian army repels American vessels trying to violate Iran's southern waters. This is one of the scenarios of the first phase of a massive naval drill staged by the Iranian army's navy. Codenamed Zulfaghar, the maneuver is conducted over an area stretching from the Persian Gulf Strait of Hormuz to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean.
The large-scale Zulfaghar maneuver is underway with the goal of integrating our network of armed forces and testing our naval defense capabilities. In this drill, we have carried out different defensive and offensive operations using our own domestically developed military equipment.
The drill involved all of the four branches of the Iranian army in 3 days of exercises. On the first day, the Navy conducted beaching or amphibious operations, which involved Marines in an operation ashore aimed at assaulting the enemy's coastal units.
Beaching an amphibious operation is an Iranian initiative which has long been adopted by different navies around the world. It's an effective way of breaking into the enemy's coast. Beaching has advanced over time according to the advances in the hardware, but the idea and the way it's implemented remains the same.
The first phase of the maneuver saw the use of the latest hardware built domestically by the Iranian armed forces, including surveillance and reconnaissance drones such as Ababil 3 and Mohajer 6, which can also conduct tactical and combat missions. The drill also involved the use of surface-to-surface missiles such as Dehlavieh guided missile to protect the Iranian beach against the enemy's amphibious operations.
The Iranian Navy says this is a routine drill which is staged every year to boost its naval force and fine-tune its homegrown military equipment. It says using its weapons, it is now fully prepared to confront any threat to Iran's territorial waters. Yusuf Jalalip from the location of the drill.
South Korea plans to significantly boost military spending over the next 5 years, an annual increase of nearly 7%. The Eastern Asian country aims to spend over $440 million on anti-drone weapons alone. The announcement comes only days after North Korea flew drones into the South Territory for the first time in 5 years. According to South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff, Monday, five North Korean drones crossed the border before breaking formation. Four of them headed to islands in the West Sea, while one of the drones continued south, reaching the skies over the outskirts of this city, the capital, Seoul. It was the first such incident since 2017 when a drone crossed into South Korea and photographed a U.S. base here. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, a conservative who came to office in May of this year, has blamed the previous progressive government's policy of engaging Pyongyang for the recent incident.
Given that efforts or military training to respond to such UAV drones have never been properly done since 2017, I think our people must have well seen how dangerous a policy relying on an oath's good faith and peace agreements would be.
South Korea plans more joint military exercises with the U.S. for 2023, although much of the public wants talks with North Korea and a de-escalation of tensions. Meanwhile, North Korea has unveiled new goals for the country's military. Addressing a large committee meeting of the ruling Workers' Party, leader Kim Jong-un indicated on Wednesday that the country will continue its military development in 2023 after a record year of missile testing. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italy's far-right government is about to adopt a security decree that will introduce a compulsory code of conduct for NGO-run ships rescuing asylum seekers in the Mediterranean Sea. Since day one of its mandate, the Giorgia Meloni government has pledged to press ahead with an agenda aimed at stopping what it calls irregular migration. The new measures will force NGO-run ships to deliver rescued asylum seekers to port immediately without waiting to pick up more people at sea or transferring asylum seekers to larger vessels. Under the new rules, rescued people will also have to apply for asylum in the country where the NGO-run ship is flagged in. Italy's Interior Minister Matteo Piantedosi has said the new provisions aim to prevent organized campaigns to transport asylum seekers departing from Libya and other countries to Italy.
We asked if the migrant issue would be the main focus of the next year's opening council of the EU ministers' meeting. The EU needs a serious and constructive approach on the matter in order to draw a clear distinction between asylum seekers and irregular migrants.
According to the Italian government, saving lives at sea has contributed to increasing migration, and while some NGO ships genuinely carry out rescues, others engage, quote, in systematic searches for people in cahoots with migrant traffickers. Humanitarian groups have warned that the government's measures will stop them from saving lives.
Bisogna informare.
People departing from Libya and other countries for Italy must be immediately informed by the media about the risks they would face by crossing the Mediterranean Sea, so that they can reconsider their decision. The best-case scenario for them is to end up in a detention center in Libya. It's hell for people in there.
Over 90,000 people have arrived at Italy's ports this year. Rome has been stopping many NGO-run ships from docking in the country, on one occasion sparking a diplomatic rift with France after an NGO-run vessel flying the French flag was denied entry. Italy's policies on the migrant issue have been strongly condemned over the years. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal authorizes Italy and the EU to help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence, and abuse are practiced. That deal today is still in place. Max Civilli, Rome.
Brazil is less than a week away from Lula da Silva's return to the presidency, and preparations are underway for a massive festival in Brasilia, which will be held alongside the official events. Tens of thousands of members of social movements and Lula supporters from around the country are preparing to travel to the capital, many of whom will be camping out to celebrate the new government at the Festival of the Future, for which dozens of Brazilian artists have confirmed their performances. There is both a sense of excitement and tension as protests against the incoming government by supporters of outgoing Jair Bolsonaro are expected. Despite multiple thwarted plots, called terror plots by the incoming government, people are determined to make their way to Brasilia.
I'm going to Brasilia from Sao Paulo to be there for the inauguration of our president Lula, who will be there, which is very satisfying and makes me proud. And I'm also looking forward to participating in the celebrations and festivities of the social movement.
I'm heading to the inauguration of our president Lula. I want to be with him at the festivities, singing and supporting him, because there are so many good things to happen in our country.
The presidential transition is advancing, and President-elect Lula has been making known some of his ministerial appointments. Among the most notable are singer, songwriter, and actress Margareth Menezes, who will take on the role of Minister of Culture, and lawyer and writer Silvio Almeida, who serve as Minister of Human Rights. Lula's former environmental minister, Marina Silva, will take another turn heading the ministry. Sources close to Jair Bolsonaro say that he will not be handing off the presidential sash to Lula da Silva and will be taking an extended holiday at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in the United States. Camila Escalante, Sao Paulo.
Lebanon's economic meltdown is about to enter its fourth year, with additional afflictions in its trail.
Although the country could finally hold the much-awaited parliamentary elections, it entered the trap of a presidential election stalemate.
With the mindset and the mentality of many of the Lebanese politicians, I think it's a very difficult process. You mentioned the Lebanese forces. It's known the Lebanese forces have this blind hatred and ideological demonization of other parties, first and foremost Hezbollah. This facilitates the intervention of foreign parties like Saudi Arabia, who are said to put a veto on certain presidential candidates.
The year 2022 was not all towards a downfall for Lebanon. The year marked the finalization of a maritime border deal signed by Lebanon and Israel after more than a decade of on-off indirect talks. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. He also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue.
What happened in Nakara is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
Analysts believe Hezbollah made the right calculations in this move.
What stood out for me was the pragmatism exercised by Hezbollah in this particular agreement. It was very pragmatic in its approach, focusing, I think, first and foremost on Lebanon's economic interests, particularly with the dire economic situation. I think it was also a smart game played by Hezbollah, because I think that they believed deep down there was a conviction by the leadership that Biden couldn't afford another war and would prevent Israel from launching a war, even if Israel had a wish.
The deal is also seen as one of the major achievements of former President Michel Aoun, who stepped down in November without a successor. Now, while Lebanese lawmakers have so far failed to elect a new president, a caretaker cabinet remains in place since the parliamentary vote last spring, showing no sign of efforts to implement economic reforms.
As Lebanon ends the year 2022 without a president, observers are skeptical that any achievement concerning this file can be achieved soon. However, many believe that prospects for gas production and export are promising in the new year. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that, more than $300 billion, is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to economic analysts, the rise in prices and interest rates in the United Kingdom has now become a common concern for many Britons. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story. According to a survey, two-thirds of British consumers are planning to cut their discretionary spending in 2023 amid concerns about the cost of living crisis. Highlighting the pressure on families and the wider economy from inflation, the accountancy firm KPMG said 61% of consumers in a poll of 3,000 were preparing to reduce their spending on eating out, holidays and other non-essentials. The survey found concerns over the cost of basic items such as food, energy, fuel and mortgage or rent costs, as well as worries over how much further these could rise, were the biggest deterrents for discretionary spending. With inflation above 10% for the first time since the early 1980s, households across Britain have tightened their belts to accommodate soaring gas and electricity bills and the rising cost of weekly shopping, prompting the Bank of England to warn about a lengthy recession. Official forecasts show sky-high inflation will erode average real pay and cut living standards by 7% over the 2 years to the end of March 2024, wiping out the previous 8 years of growth. Highlighting the uneven impact for some families, the KPMG survey showed 1 in 10 adults have no savings. Only 4% said they would be able to increase their non-essential spending levels in 2023, while a quarter would stay at their 2022 level. Of these with savings, 43% said they were using them to help meet essential costs. This rises to more than 80% among some low-income households, reflecting the disproportionate impact of living costs on poorer families. 1 in 10 consumers highlighted concern about energy bills after April, when the government will reduce the amount of support available to families by increasing the cap on average bill from £2,500 to £3,000 for a typical household. Consumers also cited the end of fixed-term mortgage deals as well as variable-rate mortgages as barriers to their spending. KPMG said a third of consumers in Britain plan to buy more own-brand and value products in 2023, while a third would buy fewer items altogether. The most common areas for saving on discretionary spending were eating out, 46%, clothing, 42%, takeaways, 42%, Linda Ellett, UK Head of Consumer Markets, Retail and Leisure at KPMG, said current essential costs, fears of how high they'll rise, including concerns about mortgage rates and energy price changes next year, are all factors in why two-thirds of consumers that we surveyed said they have to reduce their non-essential spending in 2023. The British newspaper The Express has also covered the same story. Amid the worsening cost of living crisis this winter, new research revealed a large proportion of households in Britain are worried about losing their income at some point over the next year. Crippling housing costs have long been one of the main engines of homelessness in Britain, but soaring energy bills and record rents mean more people than ever now find themselves at risk. In order to stave off this most severe of outcomes, many have been cutting back on spending over the holidays. According to a new survey by Beam, a social impact startup helping refugees and homeless people find work and housing, 35% of people in Britain believe they're at risk of becoming homeless in 2023. Conducted in November, these fears reflect escalating concern over rising prices generally. Britain's inflation came in at 10.7% last month, only a slight fall back from the 42-year record high of 11.1% in October. Energy prices have been the main driver of inflation throughout the year, pushing up the cost of heating and using electricity for households to untenable levels, just as the winter cold sets in. Research by the International Monetary Fund, published in September, found the poorest 10% of households in Britain would be spending 17.8% of their income on energy alone in 2022. Reflecting this, just under half of the Beam survey's respondents said their housing costs have increased by as much as 22% in the past 6 months, while 32% reported worrying that costs will continue to go up over the next 6 months. The same proportion, about 32%, reported they were concerned they wouldn't be able to cover their housing costs in the near future. If costs were to rise beyond what they could afford and they'd lost their home, a quarter of Britons polled confessed they would have nowhere else to go and would be forced to live on the streets. According to the charity Crisis, homelessness can result from a loss of job, the breakdown of a relationship, or the onset of physical or mental health problems. However, the claim the most common cause is no longer being able to afford housing costs. In the year to March, a total of 133,460 families were affected by homelessness in England, the latest report from the Department of Levelling Up, Housing and Communities, an 11.3% increase on the previous year. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story. The cost of living crisis is affecting people's retirement plans, with millions of workers across the country deciding to cut back on their pension contributions to help pay for rising food and energy costs. New research from the Pensions Management Institute, PMI, found that in the past year, people have abandoned payments into their retirement funds to keep hold of £550 or more as high interest rates continue to bite. The research body found abandoning such savings could delay employees' plans to pack in work by 3 years, with 28% of those surveyed believing they will never be able to retire. It comes as millions of Britons face a surprise hike in energy bills from 1st of January, as the economic crisis continues to deepen. According to the Pensions Management Institute PMI, 20% of staff have opted out of their workplace's pension scheme or asked for their contributions reduced over the last year. A further 20% are considering taking similar steps to create some extra cash to use now. By axing their pension contributions each month, those on low salaries of £20,000 a year can boost their take-home pay by around £550 a year. Those higher earners, therefore, will be able to increase their take-home each month even further. However, avoiding pension payments means that employees would miss out on their employer's tax relief, resulting in less being saved for their later years. The Pensions Management Institute PMI surveyed 2,000 employees in November and found that 7% had taken a decision to opt out in the last 12 months. A further 13% asked to reduce their pension contributions, meaning they would miss out on parallel contributions from their employer, with a further 20% considering ceasing funding their pension pots. The number of savers feeling impact of the ongoing cost of living crisis was 40%, with three-quarters of employees having considerable concerns that the current economic crisis would have a detrimental effect on their retirement plans.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear friends, salamun alaikum. Welcome to this episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. On the continuation of this program, we'll listen to today's story, Best Day to Pray. There was a young boy who doesn't like to pray his five daily prayers. He was very lazy. He thought that performing the prayers daily was very troublesome indeed. One day, he had a great idea. He figured that he should find out which day of the week is the best day in which to pray. And he'll pray very, very well on that day. As for the rest of the week, he'll just relax and not worry about any prayers at all. He went to his grandfather. Grandpa, which day of the week is the best day to pray out five daily prayers? My grandson, the best day to pray is the day before you die. The boy was astonished. Grandpa, that's impossible. How can I know the day of my death? Exactly, my grandson, the wise man replied. No one knows the day of his death. That's why we need to pray every single day.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear audience, sisters and brothers from all over the world. Welcome to another new episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. This is Sister Zainab and our topic for today's episode is prayer as one of the pillars of Islam. Well, the story we just listened to is about saying prayer and its philosophy in life. About the values of prayers, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said that As-salat faridatun khayrun min 20 hajja wa hajjatun khayrun min baytin mamlu dhahaban yatasaddaqu minhu hatta yafna. Well, there are many people who believe that only the prayers of Anbiya and the infallible Imams are accepted and influential. However, the fact is that if a person pays enough attention to his or her own prayer and prays in a humble way with concentration of what he or she performs, the result would be just as satisfactory as it is expected. You know, the spirit of Salat is intention, devotion, and contemplation. Without contemplation, Salat would be only a futile utterance. Imam Ali alayhi salam recommended Kumail ibn Ziyad about some features and qualities of prayer. In that regard, he said, "O Kumail, the status and value of worshipping God doesn't lie beneath prayer, fasting, or charity, but the value of your prayer is to perform it with a clean and concentrated heart and perform a God-pleasing act in a humble way that it will encompass your whole soul. Therefore, it is necessary that you gather all your attention and do not pay attention to what is going around you and keep the distance between yourself and anything that diverts your attention." Okay, up until now, we talked about the necessity and benefits of Salat. However, there are some people who are aware of these benefits, but still they avoid saying prayer and use trivial excuses about that. It is good to know that as performing prayer brings light and success to the life of a believer, abandoning prayer has terrible consequences, the most important of which is the act of disobeying the Creator. This is the most serious and obvious consequence. Okay, let's have a break and we will be back in no time.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
Welcome back, dear audience. You're listening to Lantern. The whole purpose of your existence is to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And when you avoid doing your mission intentionally, you must be waiting for severe consequences in this world and the hereafter. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the 59th verse of Surah Al-Maryam announces that فَخَلَفَ مِنْ بَعْدِهِمْ خَلْفٌ أَضَاعُوا الصَّلَاةِ وَاتَّبَعُوا الشَّهَوَاتِ فَسَوْفَ يَلْقُونَ غَيَّا. Then there has succeeded them a generation who have given up prayer and have followed their desires. Therefore, they will be thrown in hell. Abandoning prayer also shows how ungrateful a person is. Refusing the invitation of the Creator to establish this close relationship with Him is the ultimate ingratitude. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created human beings and gave them everything. In that regard, He says, قُلْ هُوَ الَّذِي أَنْشَأَكُمْ وَجَعَلَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ قَلِيلًا مَا تَشْكُرُونَ. It is He who has created you and endowed you with hearing, seeing, and hearts. Little are you grateful. Surah Al-Mulk, verse number 23. Not performing prayer will lead one to misery. Those human beings that have no connection with Allah helplessly seek an alternative and leave no stone unturned looking for calmness and bliss. Human, however, searches in vain and wandering aimlessly. We must keep that in our minds that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't need our prayer. He doesn't need anything from anybody, and it is us who stand in need of His mercy. So, you can see, my friends, that abandoning prayer might seem simple for those who do that, but it affects so many aspects of this life and the hereafter. It is so crucial that we as Muslims perform our obligatory prayers in the best way possible and enjoy the benefits of God's servanthood. Well, it seems that our time for today's episode is up. Today we talked about vitality and benefits of performing prayer, and we said that abandoning Salat results in nothing but misery. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala help us in this path, in the path of servanthood, and protect all of us with His love and mercy. Well, until another episode, I bid you farewell, and may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.